Thanks very much. And thanks to Ritline for having me. Just by way of preamble, before this novel was published, I would talk to other novelists about the business of reading. They were always quite sardonic about it. They said there was always something arbitrary about what you chose to read. Nothing could be really sort of emblematic of what the book was. And when a book's as fat as this item here, it's more than usually arbitrary as to what one picks. It is ostensibly a novel of four major characters whose stories interlace and move back and forward in time. An Anglican priest comes to Newcastle in 1996 to start a church in a deprived part of town, and he has three influential and then disastrous relationships, one with a Labour MP, one with a single mother with whom he has a relationship, and the third with a fearsome local criminal who also, in the ironic way of these things, is widely adored in the sinkhole estates where the priest is plying his trade, because he's an aspirational figure in some ways. Now, one of the funny things about when a book does get published, and if anyone pays any attention to it, then it stops being yours, and you find out what you've written rather than what you thought you'd written. And I thought that my lead character was the priest, John Gore, who begins the book by arriving in town with a spiritual mission. And the main drama, as it seemed to me, were his actions that determine the principal dramas and the denouement. But then immediately a lot of reviewers decided that, in fact, that the main character was that hard man, Steve Coulson, that he was actually the principal and most sympathetic figure. And then some people have bought the rights to do a television version of this for Channel 4, and when I met them for the first time, they said, we're very keen to get your views on the casting of the main character, Steve Coulson. So at that point, I realized there was no point pretending that my intentions were the correct one. So when I first started reading from the book, I would always read bits about John Gore. But tonight I'll just read some bits about the aforementioned Steve Coulson. they come at various points in the book because of this back and forward motion I described, but I'll try and do them roughly in chronological order and be quick about it. Steve is born on Wearside in the mid-60s in a poor family. His dad's a car mechanic. His mother tends the home. He has no great aspirations in life, he thinks, other than to be happy, and everything seems to conspire against that simple ambition. This is a little scene. Steve has a good relationship with his dad, but for other various reasons and various other people, it starts coming apart. His dad's called Bobby. Their routine was sacred. Every Saturday, Bobby would take him for snooker at the Excelsior Working Men's Club. They would contest a frame or two, then Bobby would mingle with his pals, and Stevie would sit it out patiently, the bairn in the corner, with a bag of Tudor crisps and a glass of iced Cresta. This was Stevie's treat. And yet he grew to hate these outings, for somehow old Doggett was always there, holding court. And Jim Doggett, somehow, was Bobby's best mate. It had been so since school, but Doggett became a bricklayer, a rated one, and in short order he was a site boss with hopes of advancement. He carried himself about the Excelsior as though he were a boss man of all he surveyed, smoking odious Panatella cigarillos, drinking Johnny Walker whiskey, chased by a straight glass of ale. Fond of producing a black plastic comb, spitting upon it, and dragging it through his pompous thatch of rusty hair and meaty sideburns. "Hello, Tiger," he would wink at his reflection behind the optics. From Stevie's vantage, this was the behaviour of an outright ponce. And yet, Doggett seemed to think he had bottled the very essence of machismo. Bobby and others in his retinue would tease him a little, but Doggett was a bachelor. And the man himself merely grinned at them glancingly, shooting back, without apparent irony, "Ah, lads, see, but I'm saving myself for Miss Wright." Doggett had quite a few such stock gags, to wit, "That's a smart top you've got on there, son," his customary greeting to Stevie whenever the boy drew near, clad in whatever ragged t-shirt he had cleaned to wear with his flares. Doggett affected a fly-collar shirt and a black waistcoat, his packet of tabs tucked into a dainty pocket, and seemed to think himself the very glass of fashion. Stevie would have been the first to confess he cared nothing for clothes, considered them girl stuff in any case. But he was quite certain Doggett looked about as smart as a sack of fucking spuds, whatever fancy gear he squeezed his lard arse into. His breath stank and all, what with the rot-gut scotch and the foul smokes. Stevie just couldn't tell the bastard to his face. If Doggett were a bully, bloated with talk, nonetheless he carried some weight and threw it about. And Bobby, too, deferred to him, plainly. It pained Stevie. He felt himself a four-square lad. No squirt, no titch. He had no fear of his teachers, not even Finlayson, the blackbeard yob who taught physics and picked the football team. He had no fear of classmates who told him that he smelled, or called his dad grease monkey. For what did theirs do that was so bloody great? Doggett, though, was a different case, and Stevie coveted a share in that kind of size and authority. At 13 years old, he knew, he just didn't have it. Doggett becomes Stevie's stepfather, wouldn't you know it? The Miss Wright he's saving himself for is Stevie's mam. Stevie's dad's driven out of the house, Doggett occupies the space, he and Stevie fight. Yeah, here's a little bit of life Shea Stevie once Doggett is the father of the house, and things have come to a bad point. On a freezing day before Christmas of 1978, Doggett's brother Frank brought his family up from Darlington. This is to Wearside. Stevie was warned to behave, and the thought of more identikit Doggetts infesting the place was hateful to him. But Frank's young daughter Lucy was blonde, a bit lush, and conspicuously friendly. As the day passed into evening and the adults grew merry, Stevie took his chance to cozy up. She smelled just marvellous, and didn't turn away or disdain him, but smiled very prettily. When she snuck off to the bathroom, Stevie tailed her, and on the upstairs landing, he took her into his arms without a battle. It was dark, the kiss was juicy. It was all magic. Then she tensed. Stevie did not believe he had read wrong. Then he knew his error. It was in the creaky tread on the carpeted stair. They had been observed. Doggett, of course, now ascending, a vision of wrath, unleashing his belt from about his lardy waist. Stevie wanted to laugh until Lucy no longer hung on him and Doggett was lashing out with the buckle end. He managed to grab hold, but the great lump used his weight and forced Stevie to the floor, and now they had an audience. Doggett got him by the cuffs of his tracksuit bottoms and dragged him bumping down the stairs. The pants came half off, exposing Stevie's red Y fronts and, most evil of all, his cock, semi-erect, poking midway through the vent. The humiliation burned white hot. But barely for a moment before Doggett had hauled him and shoved him out the front door. Stevie girded himself to trade punches when he heard the latch drop, realizing he was left in the biting cold. He paced, he heard Mary, his mother, within. Her "let him in," rebuffed in irate tones. Adrenaline rushing, he strode directly round the back, swaddled his fist in his t-shirt, and thrust it through the glass of the door to the kitchen. Before he could fumble his way in, Uncle Frank had barreled out, thrown two meaty arms around his chest, cursed him for an animal, and thrown him to the ground. Stevie stomped 2 miles to his nana's and granddad's in Mount Pleasant, refusing to admit the cause. His nana was all for putting on her coat and hat and going round, but Stevie had made up his mind. This fracture had been a long time coming, if no less a misery having come. He rose at first light the next morning, took a loan of George's Macintosh, and got aboard the X-30 bus to Newcastle. In Newcastle, Stevie is homeless for a while, and then he finds a live-in bar job, at a miserable drinker in the west end of Newcastle, one of the most deprived areas. A barman there takes some pity on him and introduces him, Stevie, to his own chief hobby. This is Jeff, the friendly barman. And Jeff's chief hobby is lifting weights, in which Stevie will find his own vocation. When Jeff peeled down to his black rainbow t-shirt, that's Rainbow the band, not the TV program, A startling musculature was unveiled, even though he wore bookworm specs and a swattish air. Sometimes when Stevie sought out his room between shifts, Jeff would be on the stairs perusing Black Belt magazine or World of Judo. Stevie took care to let Jeff see his interest, and Jeff at length took pity, proposing that Stevie accompany him east of town to a place called Morton's of Wall's End. It was a timber frame shed with a pitched roof and one frosted window. Within, on a concrete floor laid with rubber mats, were stacks of free weights, a row of clunking machines, and a dozen or so big, grunting, half-naked men. Stevie ignored the sharp, commingled stench of cheese and embrocation, for these men looked like he wanted to look. They glowered back at him, some with eyes alarmingly close set. But Jeff steered him about, urged him to try his hand, spotted him under the bench press bar. Then he engaged the proprietor, a retired shot putter, in a muttered conference, and a deal was cut on Stevie's behalf. After changing, they sat by a small service counter, and Jeff brought them both gloopy refreshments of dried protein powder in milk. He waved away Stevie's halting gratitude. "Do you want to others, Stevie, lad? Do you want to others? It's about treating people decent. That way they treat you the same. You'll do something for me someday." Stevie pledged himself to the discipline of iron. "There are principles," Jeff told him, near comically hushed and earnest. "They go from man to man. You won't get them out of books." For that much, Stevie was glad. Morton's became his home from the gunnery, and a model home at that, a safe haven. Its members respected one another's purpose and work rate. There was no posing or picking on, and a man was as anonymous as he cared to be. Why couldn't the world be like that? Stevie fell hard for the iron, the pull and the push of it, the sweet ache of the exertion, his confident management of it, but above all in its visible benefits. Gazing from the fastened stacks of weights to the size and shape of his burgeoning cuts of muscle, he had a pin-sharp sense that some inner faculty of his was being weighed in the balance and found favorable. Jeff prodded him helpfully. "Try to see in your mind the person you want to be. Hold that picture. Work toward it." It became clearer to Stevie from whence Jeff had acquired his odd air of abstraction. Jeff also started to slip him wraps of bland little tablets, Dianabol, to have with his meals. "They'll build you up." And there was something to it, he knew, whenever he took his turn in one of Morton's two dank little shower cubicles and inspected himself. Bulkier by the day, it seemed. Those little pills, Dianabols, don't do the job, though, unfortunately, as Stevie finds, as most aspirant hard men do. He has to start injecting himself with anabolic steroids, which has a massive effect on his physique and also his persona. At that point, there's no going back. I'll probably just do one more bit, and of course we're not even nearly getting to the present tense of this book. It's Stevie's first night on the job, so to speak. He is noticed in Morton's gym and picked out by a big Bristolian bloke called Dicko, who works on a number of doors in pubs and clubs around Newcastle. He takes Stevie under his wing, offers him the chance to be an apprentice, a bouncer, which will of course become Stevie's trade. Dicko had several pitches, but it was at a disco pub in Gateshead by name of the Loose Box that Stevie presented himself on the appointed hour for his first night shift, clad in a thick black cable sweater and steel-capped Dr. Martens. Dicko surveyed him critically. "Okay, pal, stand up big, listen to me, and keep your mouth shut." As the punters arrived, the duo manned the narrow doorway and counted heads for an hour. Boring. Only when a bumptious pair tried to push their way forward did Dicko step out and make a wall of himself. Afterward, he grunted into Stevie's ear. "Them that wave their arms about, they're just trying to fool you. Stare them out. Talk it down. Nice and easy." In time they were relieved, whereupon Dicko escorted Stevie up a flight of stairs for a tour of the disco, desultory groups of females and larger packs of drinking males under spotlights and mirror balls. The dance floor felt spongy under Stevie's boots, and Dicko rolled his eyes, advised that it had been laid on top of the old pub carpet. Then he turned serious. "In here you get yourself positioned right. Assess the room, get yourself good at observation. Observation means anticipation. You see something you don't like? Send out the stare. Let them know you're watching." Within minutes, Dicko had spotted the makings of a push-and-shove altercation by the bar. And once again, from the vantage of Dicko's burly shoulder, Stevie was intrigued to see how fast the hostility fizzled down to nout, like butter in a pan. "Don't be getting D-Mob happy," Dicko cautioned him. "Breaking things up is easy. A lot of these tossers are just waiting for you to step in. They want it broken up before they get hurt." He grinned. "Now there's others. They want to do you. But, you know, proper fight, you don't feel anything anyway. Unless it really hurts." And he looked askance at Stevie. "Are you scared yet, Flower?" "I'm canny, man," said Stevie. The night was passing without major incident, even getting dull. And then Dicko had his arm around a raddled redhead. And then, with a wink, he vanished from view. Stevie was alone, stationed once more at the door, breathing the sharp night air, and thinking about the bus home, when the landlord of the loose box appeared at his side in a tizzy. "It's Steve, aye? Look, Steve, we've got this bugger. He's bother, and he's not leaving, but I want him out right now, son." "Oh, fuck, right. Where's Dicko?" "Well, he'll be shagging, won't he, son?" "Well, hang on, I'll get him." "Now, Steve, son, this needs doing now." Bollocks, thought Stevie, for the landlord was tugging at his arm, and there was no backing down from the belly-stabbing sense that this was make-or-break time. Still, he tried. "So what's his bother like, this gadgie? Will he not just get on?" "Well, I'd rather not ask him, son," said the landlord. "What am I paying you for?" Stevie strode into the disco, his legs shaky beneath him, as he crossed that spongy floor, girding up his sinews as if to inflate himself and still the quake in his bowels. In his mind's eye, he was heading in the opposite direction, out the door, free and clear. But headed where? The owner was pointing out the enemy, a shaven-headed pudding of a bloke, with a dead-eyed scowl, probably 40 years old and 20 stone in weight, a big lump cosseted by a few big lump pals. As he bore down, the gadgie's mates were clocking him, cockily, alerting their leader, who barely half-turned his head from the pint of beer raised to his mouth. "All right, then," he said. "Ye in what army, you little prick?" Stevie threw a straight right at the side of that meaty face, which cannoned gloriously into the mouth of the glass. Another right to the head, then another, then a left hook to the ribs. Stevie's hands weren't fast, but they had clout. And then the gadgie's legs were failing him, his cause forlorn, collapsing him to the floor. One of his pals made a poor feint of a move. Stevie lashed out a boot at his shins, and the howl was louder than the music. Two men down, a third looking like he might shit his pants, the area clearing and all eyes on Stevie, all in seeming awe but he. The gadgie was on all fours, so Stevie booted him in his sagging belly, and he voided the watery contents of his stomach onto the carpet. Now there was a grasping hand at Stevie's shoulder, and he beat it off before he was seized about the chest by twine-like arms. It was Dicko, bearing reinforcements. And the fire exit doors were being kicked open and bodies manhandled from the space. But Stevie was blazingly content, for truly he had felt it, the rush of hormones from the adrenals, his fear turning to propulsive hate, hate that even now overrode the raw burning pulse in his knuckles. He delegated the rest of the kicking to Dicko and waved away the landlord's ferrety gratitude, as he supposed a professional would.